This is the Secret Identity Podcast, special retrospective episode number 3 for July 25th, 2011. Today is our final retrospective looking back at the interviews we've done over 5-plus years of Secret Identity, and we'll be talking to George Lazenby, Aaron Gray, Mike Allred, and Anthony Johnston.
Hello!
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 And welcome, everybody, to the final retrospective episode of Secret Identity. This is Brian LaTenry here, as always, with the lovely Matthew A. Herring. How are you?
Doing well. It all changes next week.
It all changes next week. But before we do that, we are rounding out our retrospective with 4 great interviews.
Yes.
As we've done for the past 2 episodes, we've talked about people that we've talked to over the years who have become good friends or some of our favorite interviews. And today is no different. And we're going to start off today with an interview of somewhat of an idol of yours, probably one of the people that you were most nervous sitting down to interview, and that's Mr. George Lazenby.
Obviously, because of my love of James Bond and him being the first James Bond I ever saw on Her Majesty's Secret Service, one of my favorite all-time movies. He only made one Bond movie, and we talked a couple episodes back about how, you know, did you ever want to ask the questions? Did you ever want to do the hardball questions? This was one that I really struggled with because I wanted to talk about the fact that he only made one. Would he have liked to have made more? And I think we talk about that.
You absolutely touch on that stuff.
And a lot of it, thankfully, was him. I mean, he gave me a lot of insight to things that went on behind the scenes that I didn't even know about that, you know, and I read everything that comes out about James Bond and him especially. This was stuff that I never knew. And when I went up and asked him if he would do an interview, and at first he was kind of like, oh, I don't know. I don't really like to do these things. And then he must have saw this like puppy dog sad look on my face. And he said, why don't you come back in like an hour? Which to me is worse than saying no, because now I had an hour to screw it up in my head.
But you didn't. It came out very good. So,
thank you.
So that's our first interview today. Enjoy the interview with Mr. George Lazenby.
And the Creator Spotlight this week comes to you once again from the national show, the last show of the Big Apple Comic-Con schedule. And for more information, you can go to BigAppleCon.com to find out times and dates for the next year's show. And we are joined right now by somebody who, if you can maybe look past the nervousness I have right now, somebody that I'm a huge fan of, somebody that we reference all the time on the show. And we are talking to George Lazenby. How are you, George?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. This is an absolute thrill for me. You and I have a lot of history. Unfortunately, you don't know it. My dad, when I was about 5 or 6, sat me down to watch on Her Majesty's Secret Service. And from that moment on, you were my James Bond. That movie, to this day, is my favorite movie of all time. And I just want to thank you for that, first of all.
Well, you can thank the casting people for that, because I was, I just jumped in it out of nowhere, and I'd never acted before, and I should have done another one, but everyone advised me that James Bond was over. It was Sean Connery's gig, and you're better off just to be an actor independently. But I found I couldn't work because you know, I established myself as James Bond only, and the Bond people didn't want me to work, so there you go.
Now, that must have been an interesting time for you, because you were a model. As far as I remember, you were a model, you were on TV commercials, and all of a sudden you are now playing one of the most recognizable characters in probably in the world at that time. Was that a little bit of a culture shock for you, and how did you react to something like that?
Well, I didn't handle it that well. I'd never been famous before, per se. You know, I found that it brought a lot of things that I couldn't handle into my life, like people crowding around me all the time when I go shopping, or and that's when I was currently James Bond. They don't do it anymore, but I wish they did. make some money. But I mean, I had to educate myself about how to handle myself and what fame was all about, because fame was not what I was looking for in a real sense. I mean, I obviously sat in my bathtub one day and said, wouldn't it be great to be James Bond, to be famous and rich? But then when it happens, you go, oh my God, what am I going to do now? Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah. Now, when you look back, was it a happy time? I mean, or as the years have gone on, do you look back at it and see more of the fun that you might have had instead of some of the pain that you might have gone through or some of the uncomfortable times that you said?
Well, to be honest about it, I was never sure of myself in that period of my life, because, you know, you're meeting people that you never thought you'd meet. I mean, I can remember sitting between David Niven and Grace Kelly at dinner and thinking, oh my God, what do I do now? And they were having the dinner for me. You know, it was just weird, the whole thing. Roman Polanski was there, and he told my girlfriend that I'd already gone home, and then I left the dinner. And I mean, I was, I was in water I'd never swam in before. I was meeting all kinds of, I mean, Hugh Hefner wanted to meet me and had a dinner for me, and I mean, those type of things, which you'd like to meet him. It's very weird for someone who came off the street.
Yeah.
I wasn't brought up as an actor or a celebrity, and I didn't know any celebrities. In fact, I didn't even know an actor, believe it or not, before I got the James Bond job. So I was in a unique situation, and no one could advise me properly.
Now, when you look back at the importance of that film and the entire series, do you see that it was probably the best movie of all? And I'm not just saying that because we're here and because it is, but if you take the story, it was probably one of the most important stories. I mean, it really brought James to one level and then turned him into another level. Can you look back at that now and maybe see, you know, gee, I had a major part in the history of James Bond?
Yeah, I can. In fact, the first... when I first saw the movie, I was a little disappointed because I thought I acted better than I did. And I thought, well, what the hell? It was my first time out. I did nearly all my takes, one take. Mm-hmm. That's all Peter Hunt gave me. He thought that he was going to get it from another angle or whatever. I know I could have done it better. I certainly could now. But, I've never spoken in front of a camera before in my life, and not even get thrown into that role was, it was a little bit of an ask.
Now, were you disappointed that you didn't come back for any more?
Not until many years later, because that was a hippie time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone was wearing bloody bell bottoms and long hair, and James Bond looked like a waiter to most people. So, I wasn't immediately, but as time went on, I saw, James Bond still had legs and bigger legs than ever now. I thought, what a bad decision on my manager's part, who talked me into not doing another one. And I'd never signed a contract to this day. I signed a letter of intent, but never signed a contract.
Have you followed the films since Honor Majesty's Secret Service to the current, it's a mania again. It seems to be back and more popular than ever.
Well, I've had the opportunity to watch this new guy, the blonde fellow, and I was quite surprised how good he did, how well he did, but he was a good actor to begin with, and I saw Casino Royale, and I saw the, with the thing of Solace, just last Monday night, which isn't as good, by the way, as Casino Royale.
That's what everybody's saying.
Yeah. And so, good luck to him, and good luck to the Bond people.
Now, since you're at a show that has a lot of comic books and, the science fiction theme, I completely forgot, and I was reminded of this walking over here, that you were the voice of one of the playing cards in Batman Beyond the cartoon, if you remember that one.
Yeah, I do, vaguely.
Was that something that you auditioned for, or did you...
No, they called me up and let me have a go, because I was still famous enough for that.
Since we're finishing up right now, I just want to once again gush and thank you so much for being here. This is an absolute thrill for me. The disappointment on my part right now is that my two little daughters wanted to come, and I said, I can't. You guys can't come out of school. My wife was willing to let them go, but it was it's something that I've been able to share with them as well. They can recite all your great lines, "This never happened to the other fellow," "We have all the time in the world," all those lines, because the movie means as much to them as it did to me, as it did to my father. So I want to thank you again for all of that.
Thanks.
And thank you again for joining us. And so concludes another Creator Spotlight. Join us next week when we are going to have some guest, probably not as good as Mr. Lazenby, but we're going to have somebody, and we're going to try real hard. So on behalf of Brian, have yourself a good one.
And we are back. And coming off that interview with George Lazenby, the second one that we're going to talk about today is one that was probably your second most nerve-wracking one ever, and that is Erin Gray.
Yeah, when we met her at a... Was it a Wizard? It was the Wizard.
It was the Wizard Big Apple show.
We got there and she was setting up. And there's a certain thing that I always tell people that, you know, when you meet older celebrities, they don't necessarily look the same. So there's not that, you're not so intimidated anymore where you're like, that's the guy that was on TV or this, you know, this and that. And everybody looks a little older. When we, I think it was you, me and Becky were walking up and we saw her setting up. And I'm like, I cannot even move my legs because, dare I say, she looks better now than she did back then. And it's not makeup. We saw her first thing in the morning. Like, she just got out of bed, was setting up. I'm like, what is up with this woman? Because she's absolutely beautiful. And we started talking a little bit, and I told her I wanted to get a picture, and I'd love to do an interview. And the first thing was, you're not going to, like, do a Howard Stern thing where you're all nice to me at first, and then you're going to ask me some really embarrassing questions afterwards. I said, no, I wouldn't do that. And when that was going on, Melody Anderson walked by from Flash Gordon, who we've known for years, and she's like, oh, don't let this guy interview you. He's terrible. And then she's like, oh, gave me a big hug and, you know, said, oh, definitely talk to Matt. Matt's a really good guy and he's a big fan. And, you know, it's always fun to talk with him. So when Erin and I sat down, we had probably one of the most relaxed, fun interviews that I think she dominated a lot of it with some of her answers. Usually they run out of steam with a question. Then you have to get the next one. Everything she answered, she just kept – there was just more stuff that she was adding, and it was great.
She just furthered the legend in your mind.
Yes.
And added to the crush that you already had on her.
Still have.
Absolutely. So that's a great interview. So enjoy your interview with Erin Gray, and then when we come back, we'll answer a couple more questions.
And the Creator Spotlight coming to you from Wizard World, New York. www.wizardworld.com for more information on this show and other shows that are coming, because they are all over the world. If I sound a little stupid right now, it's because I am speaking with somebody that I'm a little intimidated by right now. And I'll say the name and you're all going to know why. Erin Gray. There we go. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It sounds like you've done this before.
I've done the interviews before and I've been nervous at one or two of them. This one I'm really, really nervous about.
I don't bite. I'm really nice.
I look back to when I was younger, and you were one of the first women characters that I said, you know what? I find her attractive. I mean, I was like 6th, 7th grade thinking, I don't know why I'm feeling this way about this person. I've never met him. I don't know what's going on.
Well, that's interesting, because a lot of my son, when he comes to these shows with me, says, Mom, you should have a T-shirt. It says, I know, I was your first, or you're the reason I knew I was straight.
Wow.
I've had that a number of times, you know, like boys that were like obviously confused, and I put them to one way or the other.
Yeah.
Than you. Even the gay ones say, I loved you, which I think is funny.
So it's funny to think about your career. You went from a model, you started out as a model, and then you went into acting, and that's kind of commonplace now, but it might not have been so much when you were younger, when you made the jump. I mean, I can only think of at that time maybe 3 or 4. Linda Carter made that jump. Lauren Hutton was another one. And you were a big-time model back then. All of a sudden, you're acting. How did that happen, and was that something that was hard to do?
How it happened was I was one of the very first models to actually speak and hold a product on a commercial. And what happened was the modeling agency that I was with started a new department. It was called TV commercials. And I was their first on-camera model spokesperson, because none of the other models, most of them were from Sweden or from they're French or they're Italian, so they had accents. I was the all-American girl, and I could do dialogue. So I started actually helping build the Ford model TV commercial with, you know, their person who was head of that department at that time, and was very successful. I was their most successful model at that time for commercials. And actually, for people in New York, they'll remember me as the Bloomingdale spokeswoman for 10 years. And I made a phrase very well known. It was called Bloomingdale's like no other store in the world. And that was sort of my thing. But anyway, I did a lot of commercials, hundreds of commercials. And at a certain point in my modeling career, I was getting older. And I figured, well, if I'm going to make the transition into acting, I better act on it right away. So, and then I made the transition. And it was, you know, obviously a new territory, new place, you know, moving from New York to Los Angeles. I was fortunate enough to go under contract to Universal Studios, and they put me to work right away. So I started working immediately.
Now, how long after you'd made that jump did Buck Rogers happen for you?
Almost right away. I think I went under contract by March, and by June, July, I was starring in Evening in Byzantium. Day I finished Evening in Byzantium, I went in and screen tested for Buck Rogers, and the rest is history.
You know, that's not too bad. A couple of months.
No, it was great. And I had my Bloomingdale's contract, so I wasn't hurting. But the only problem was that by going under contract to Universal, I became a contract player and made $600 a week starring in a series. Now think about it.
Wow.
$600 a week. So who lost on that deal? Wasn't necessarily the smartest thing I ever did. But anyway, it's still the best role I've ever done.
Now, when you signed on, I was talking to Gil a little bit about this, that it was a movie. A lot of people don't remember that it was a movie in the movie theater before it went to TV. Now, did you know and were you aware of the fact that they were going to make this a TV show after the movie? Or did you just sign on to do the movie? They said, hey, we're doing a TV show, and you just signed on with that, too.
Okay, first I'm going to say make a statement. IMDb Pro, get your act together. Buck Rogers was one of the top five best top-selling films, box office successes in 1978. So please put it up on IMDb and stop ignoring our requests. That's number one.
There we go.
Yeah, I'm sorry. A little ticked off. Number two, Gil had a different understanding than I did. I was told that originally Buck Rogers was going to be a 10-hour miniseries.
Yeah.
Okay, and if you'll notice, the first five movies are all two-hour movies, right, that spun off. So after I finished the first 2 hours, I was then not called back to work for quite a few months. And so I figured, oh, well, I guess it's not happening.
Yep.
And then I'm brought back the following spring. I think we did it in fall, August, September, and then following March, I came back to suddenly now it was a feature film. And I didn't know about it. Gil says he knew all the time, but, you know, he was the star, so.
There we go. So you had a nice couple years on that show. You went to Silver Spoons afterwards. And it's funny because I'm sitting there, every time I'd say, oh, she was in that show with Ricky Schroeder and the guy who I always confuse with Bruce Boxleitner, and that was Joel Higgins.
Oh, right, right. Very funny. You're right. He does have a similar look, or I could see that, right.
So when I think about Buck Rogers, and this is something, I don't know if anybody's ever given you a lot of credit for your acting. There was one episode in the second season, and the second season, you know, for a lot of fans, was kind of a slower, not so much as the excitement of the first. There was an episode where, and it was something about Oasis was the planet. I don't know if you're good with the memories of these, but there was a scene, and you had a guy that you either had a relationship with before, or you wanted to have a relationship, and to save the group you were in, he pulled his head off.
Oh, yes.
And
Mark Leonard. Yes, thank you.
Your acting in that was absolutely amazing because I remember watching this going, this is the corniest thing. Holy cow, she's really good in this one. It got me a little bit emotional because you really, I mean, I don't know what it's like to have the person I love or want to be in a relationship with pull their head off. That's kind of a new territory.
Yeah, definitely.
You did a really good job with that whole disappointment and, oh my gosh, this is not so good. I was really shocked, so I want to give you props on that one.
Well, thank you. I'm going to have to look at that again. It's been so long since I've done it. I remember thinking, whoa, okay, how am I going to do this? But thank you. I guess I pulled it off, so I really appreciate it. You'll also know that a lot of the storylines did not go through my character, so I didn't really have too many opportunities to necessarily act. Walk in, hold my gun, say a line or two, or in the second season, are you all right, Buck? I mean, you know, lost all my power. But occasionally, my favorite episode is the vampire episode.
Oh, I had to ask you about that one because a friend of mine is terrified. He sees pictures of that vampire. I'm like, his ears, I think, were upside down. How could you be afraid of him?
Yeah. But it was terrifying. And I cannot tell you how many men come to my table here and meet me and go, oh, God, when I was 8 years old, I had nightmares. years. It scared the hell out of me. You know, and now they look at it and they laugh. They go, how could it? But it was scary for kids particularly. That was my favorite episode. I loved working with the director, Larry Stewart. Was a fabulous guy. It was the only episode that a storyline was written through my character mm-hmm. from all the way through. That was great. And just working with Christopher Stone, who was Dee Wallace Stone's
yep.
Ex-husband, and he's passed away now. But it was just one of those things where everything came together. And I love playing the good girl and the bad girl, which was fun as well.
Now, another role that you went into that I didn't know anything about because I'm not a horror film guy. You were in Friday the 13th?
Yes.
Was it Jason Goes to Hell? Is that the one?
Jason Goes to Hell or The Final Friday. Sometimes I think there's two titles. I get confused myself, but it's number 9.
There we go. Now, were you a fan of horror movies at all?
No.
Or was this something you kind of just said, all right, I'll do it?
Actually, it was the director called me up and begged me to do it. And he was so cute, and he was so funny on the phone. And he said, Aaron, it's not a horror film. I said, excuse me? No, it's black comedy. I swear to God, you're going to, you know, when you go, it's like there's a serial of, you know, the fans all have all the in-jokes. You'll go to the screening. The audience is going to be talking back to the screen. They're going to say, it's behind the door, dummy, you know, and they're going to be laughing.
Yeah.
And you know what? He was right.
Yeah.
When I saw it in the movie theaters, the fans were so participatory. And talking back to the screen and having a good time was like a major party. And I went, you know, he was right. There was one scene, however, that I did not agree to do that was in the movie. Fans, you'll have to guess which one it was. You'll have to see it again. I was not happy about that. Let's put it that way. It was not what I signed up for. It was not in the script. They added it later.
Wow. Do you remember how you died? I know somebody told me how you died. I didn't know if you, because I never saw it. I'm going to have to. But do you remember how you died?
Yes. It was a knife sharpener that was thrown quickly and went spinning through the air and stabbed me in the back. But it was the sharpener part.
Did you cringe when you saw it on the screen for the first time?
No, I loved it. I thought that was cool. I loved that. Of course, when my daughter saw me in that and one other film where I get beheaded, she said, Mom, I really don't need these images of you, okay? So could you just back off? I don't really need to see this. I said, oh, no, okay, fine.
So you've done kind of a little bit of a change in your life now, not so much with the acting, but you've done a lot of stuff. I was on your website, and you do a lot of charity work for a lot of women's shelters and,
right.
you know, women's in need, things like that. How did you get involved with that? Because that, I mean, I'm looking at you, and I am amazed at how good you look. And I'm saying that only because I know that when you start doing things that are to help other people, it gives you a different aura about you. And I'm seeing that. Melody Anderson, who was in Flash Gordon, is another one. She does a ton of work that doesn't do anything but help other people. And I see that, and I'm wondering, that's the glow I'm seeing about you, is that you're doing something to help other people. So when did that all come about?
Actually, I got involved with a battered women's shelter called Haven House in Pasadena, California, about the time I got a divorce. Unfortunately, I went there for counseling and could not understand how a strong, capable, smart woman like myself could have been in a relationship that was so damaging. And they gave me the understanding that I needed and helped me sort of piece my life back together again. And I am forever grateful.
Wow.
And I got, the more research that I did and the more I got to know this particular shelter, the more I realized how important the work was that they were mm-hmm. doing. And then I got on the board of directors, and I started, so I know where every dollar goes. And I'm one of those people that I don't give money unless I know
yep.
who's running the company and what's really happening. And so the issue is very important to my heart and soul. And then since I know the people and I'm on the board and I see all the financial sheets, I know what's going on. And they're hurting right now. It's a tough year
mm-hmm.
for a lot of shelters, as a matter of fact. I'll be giving a speech in Columbus, Ohio in a couple of weeks because I go around the country educating people about domestic
yep.
violence issues. How to recognize a batterer, how to, you know, educate your teenage daughter as to how to pick out the ones early on and recognize the signs of who an abuser is. And I enjoy doing that. I really love meeting people and telling them and sharing that and helping to help the shelters as well. But I also, my real passion, and it's another way of helping people, is I teach Tai Chi.
Yeah.
I'm a Tai Chi master, and that's helping people, giving them the tools to how to strengthen their immune system and giving them not only a good workout for the rest of their life, I mean, you can be 80 years old and still doing Tai Chi, and something that strengthens their immune system, and teaching them a martial art so they can defend themselves.
Yep.
You know, so it's a it's considered three things: a moving meditation, a healing art, and a martial art. So it's a great workout.
And you're definitely keeping busy. You also, I saw on the website, and I'll finish you with this one. You do motivational speaking.
Yes.
And I saw on the website that you spoke, and they mentioned several companies. One of the companies that you spoke at is a company I work for.
Oh, which one?
UPS.
Oh, yeah. They gave me a standing ovation. I love those guys.
And the thing that cracked me up was I'm like, okay, obviously she didn't come to my building because I would have remembered that. So where was that? Where were you when you did that?
That was in Southern California. Because I was representing Haven House at that event. It was their annual fundraiser that they do, and they like people to come in and speak to motivate the employees, and that was a very successful one. So that was Southern California. Where exactly? I can't remember if it was outside of Pasadena. I just remember,
As long as Big Brown showed you respect, that's all that matters.
It was great. And I just love the fact that when I finished, they literally leapt to their feet and applauded me. I've never had it like that. So I have a fondness in my heart for those guys.
And that's good. I just, last week was my 18th year at the company. So it's been a long ride. And I thank you so much for taking the time out to talk with us. I know that you're busier than most here at the show because you're doing a lot of representation. So you have to make sure people are where they're supposed to be. Thank you for just the fun I had as a kid. All those great memories of watching you and watching Gil and being able to share it with my daughters and have my wife go, I remember watching that show. Yeah, it was okay. And just thank you for all the things that you're doing outside of what, you know, what you were trained to do. It's great to hear people giving back.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And just to let the fans know that I do have an independent feature film coming out. Sandy Calora shot a fabulous sci-fi film called Hunter Prey. And I am the voice of the robot in that. And then there's another film called Dreams Awake that I'm starring in that's sort of otherworldly. Okay. And you can see me at the Ghostbusters video game as the, Spider Witch. Oh, yeah, lovely. Come on.
So you're definitely keeping busy. That is awesome. So thank you again for joining us. So on behalf of my show partner, Brian, who's around here somewhere, and Aaron Gray, this is the Matt Man. Have yourself a good one till we talk again.
All right, and we are back, and we have been answering questions over the past couple of episodes that people have asked about the show. And Skull Daddy asked, what are the sources for all the sound bites that you have at the beginning of each episode? I know most of them, but a couple of them still have me stumped. Now, we're going to have a new theme song.
That probably would have been something we should have told everybody, too.
Which will be a bit of a revelation now because we're a week away. However, in the original theme song, the original one started with the Three Stooges.
Yep.
And then we ended up cutting that out, and it was 3-2-1 Contact that it started out with. However, the voices that you hear in the background, you have the Bixby Hulk.
Yep.
You have the Val Kilmer Batman. You have a quote from Bruce Campbell in Army of Darkness. Ben Stiller from Dodgeball. Kurt Russell from Big Trouble in Little China, my favorite movie of all time. Christopher Lloyd from Back to the Future. Mm-hmm. And we round out with Rocky the Squirrel from the Rocky and Bullwinkle show. So those are the sound bites that were in the current theme song of Secret Identity. Bellevue Coog wants to know, who would win in a fight, Brian versus Matt, with both of you guys in spandex?
Well, you know what? I think the people who watched would all be winners because they got to see us in spandex.
I was just going to say the exact opposite. Everybody loses that fight. I would have to give the edge to Matt. He's a former hockey player.
Yeah.
So he's used to throwing down.
I will say that, I mean, I can't even think about getting into a fight with somebody I care about. One of my big things that I always tell people is that people used to think I was like this tough, tough, tough kid. I was bone thin when I was a kid, but I remember getting into a fight with somebody and they got on top of me and I'm claustrophobic and I pulled like a, you know, 20-pound woman pulling a car off her kid. I went insane and this kid flipped off me because I was like, I couldn't breathe. I got panicky. So I have more of a – I had a fear going in.
Now you've shown us your Achilles heel. But I was going to say if you can picture the slap fight that George Costanza and Jerry got in one episode of Seinfeld.
That's us.
That's probably what the fight between us would look like.
Yeah.
If I had the
rules. No face. No face.
Absolutely.
Not to blow the belt.
There would be so many rules. By the time we were done, we wouldn't have even fought.
Yep.
What else? I think that might be it for questions. It is. So let's get on with our interview. So we talked to George Lazenby. We talked to Aaron Gray. Now we're going to talk to someone who you sat down with at the first Boston Comic Con that you and I went to. And he ended up, this is a good chunky interview that you did with both he and his wife, and that's Mr. Mike Allred.
And Laura was there as well, his wife. And Mike is a guy that he didn't do a shows for an awful long time. It was like 7, 8, 9 years that a lot of people didn't even know what was going on with him. And then Madman came back. So he started doing the show circuit thing, and I didn't know what to expect from him. When I started talking with him, not only is he a good-looking guy, and his wife is absolutely beautiful. He is one of the nicest guys you'd ever want to talk to. He is a Beatles fanatic. He's a James Bond fanatic. He's a comic book fanatic. So there were these things that just we just clicked right away. And when I would ask him a question, the reason this question, this interview was so long and meaty is because he answered the question fully and then expanded on every single thing, too.
And I sought out, was it his X Factor run?
Yes.
X-Statics. I'm sorry, the X-Statics run. I sought that out after this, and the thing that is kind of most upsetting to me is that this was pre-iZombie.
Yes.
And as you know, I have absolutely loved that series for the past couple of years now. So the fact that we didn't have this series when you sat down to meet with him, I would have had so many things that I wanted to talk to him about with that. But I became a fan of his after listening to this interview.
Yeah, and I ran into him in Baltimore or a couple shows later. And we started talking a little bit, and I said, you know, you've always been my favorite interview, but I said, I interviewed Erin Gray, and I think she might have trumped you. And he's like, good boy. That ought to be a better interview.
So enjoy the interview with Mr. Mike Allred.
And the Creator Spotlight coming to you from Boston Comic-Con, Boston, Massachusetts. This show is shaping up to be one of the better shows in the Northeast, not just the Boston area. And for more information on upcoming shows, you can go to www.bostoncomiccon.com. And we're joined by somebody that has been nonstop busy. I don't think you've picked your head up once since you've gotten here. One of my favorites, Mike Allred. How are you?
Really good. I prefer it that way. I like seeing a lot of people, so that's been great.
See, that's the funny thing that I've noticed is a lot of times you talk to people and they're a little kind of, I'll sign your book, here you go, and you're gone. You want to talk to people. You want to see what people are thinking and what people, you know, what their memories are of books. You're throwing stuff out that I'm like, I can't write quick enough. Slow down. Stop talking. What is it about talking to fans that turns you on?
Well, I'm a fan. You know, I have my passions, film, music, comics, and I have been blessed in the success that we've had with the comics. I've been able to run in those circles too, and so when I meet my heroes and they become my friends, it begins with that conversation, you know, and finding out what their inspirations were and what makes them tick and what they like in life, and you know. I just know that we're all people, we're all on the same planet, and it's fun when you meet people that you share things of interest. And when you go to a comic book show, I know that, first of all, I have one thing in common, we all love comic books, and then it's fun to find out what other things we have in common, what other things we like, and sometimes people will turn me on to things that I'm not aware of, and so it's really enjoyable. The flip side of that, because I don't do sketches, because I want to be hungry when I get home,
and
I want to be, you know, when I get home, I want to really want to draw again, rather than being burnt out, you know, doing sketches. That's one of many reasons why I don't do sketches. Some people, it upsets them. They don't want to talk to me. They just want to get a sketch and, you know, get out of there. So that's the negative side of it. But fortunately, the people that like our work seem to be really great, enthusiastic, friendly people, and so it's always a good time.
Now, I've been checking for a long time because I've been a big fan of yours myself, and trying to find you doing shows locally. Is this your first time in Boston, or for at least a long time, or at least the New England area?
Second time in Boston in a long time. The last time we were here was the week Jack Kirby died. I remember that very clearly. Obviously one of my big heroes and influences. So yeah, it's been a while. I mean, we get around quite a bit, but we've been fairly reclusive the past several years, and all of a sudden we just kind of got the bug again. We wanted to get out there, and this is the beginning of that wave.
Well, I'm glad you did, because for me personally, and just watching the fans lining up and talking to you, but one of the things I'm interested in about, when Madman hit and the Atomics hit with AAA Comics and what, or Pop, what you guys were doing over there, What was your life before that, as far as the comic book world? Because it seems like you took kind of a different path. You came in almost as a pioneer of this creator-owned movement that was going on at the time. I think of Billy Tucci, She, and things like that. You decided to do that instead of going the other route of, you know, maybe slinging it out in the trenches for a while. What was the whole process or thought behind that when you started out?
Oh, well, if Marvel or DC had said, hey, you want to, you know, do X-Men or Batman, I would have said, where do I sign? But, you know, I didn't know how to open those doors.
Yeah.
And I did have story ideas of my own, and so it did start with that. And since nobody was knocking my door down, I just kept doing what I wanted to do, and fortunately it became successful. So I just got lucky in that way. Early on, this isn't a secret, this is a relatively... I've whined about this for so many years, it's fairly well known. But Neil Gaiman came calling early on, right as Sandman was hitting its first big wave of success. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, my career's set. I'm going to do Sandman. But then his editor, Karen Berger, when I sent in my samples, she said, no, he's not ready yet, and shot me down. So I had this weekend of complete elation followed by a week of total destruction where my ego just went in the trash. But she was right. I mean, I was still raw. I didn't have the confidence that I would have in the next couple of years. And she came calling later and said, you know, Neil keeps bringing you up, and I'd really like, you know, to think you're ready, and if you're not mad at me, I'd like you to. And, you know, since then, I just have nothing but respect and affection for her, and I ended up doing The Golden Boy, which a lot of people have a lot of affection for, that story. So that was, you know, happy endings all around.
Yeah.
But I bring up that moment because that was the moment of whether will I do this as a career or not. This would have been 1991, I guess. So I've been doing comics full-time for about a year. I was definitely in my first year, and I really had to decide, do I get a real job? Because we were just scraping by. We were barely getting by. I think we were making more money selling T-shirts than I was on the actual comics. And so getting rejected in that way, I really had to take a hard look at myself. Like, am I willing to put in the work to build my own success, or do I go back to broadcasting, which was my previous career? And so it was. There was a moment where I almost went back to being a TV reporter, and instead it's like, no, I've taken this leap, I'm going to run with it. And soon after that, I was able to do a creator-owned work called The Everyman for Marvel. And each success was creator-owned. And so we just kind of built that groove.
Now, after Madman, you went over to, and if I've missed some things, which I probably have, I apologize, X-Force. And X-Force was a book that was one of the X-Men line. X-Men were hot at the time. You and Peter Milligan got a hold of this thing, completely turned it into a different direction. For me, I loved it because I never read any X-Men books. That was one of the first books I ever picked up. Loved it all the way through. And as I've heard you talking to some of the fans coming in and talking about that series and ecstatics, that was a really nice time in your life. You were really enjoying what you were doing. What are some of the memories about how you got involved in that, and as it ended and wound down, you know, what were your thoughts of that?
It was a thrill. We had done about a year of self-publishing The Atomics, which was a Madman spinoff, and so we had this whole new arena that we were playing in with, you know, self-publishing. It was grueling, but the discipline there was doing a monthly book, which I'd never really done. And I'd done that for almost a year and was about ready to not self-publish anymore. I kind of learned my lesson. I didn't completely reject it. But at the time, Joe Quesada took over the reins at Marvel, and we came up around the same time as artists, mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, we're on the scene about the same time. And so I called him up and like, hey, it looks like you're going to have a party there, because, you know, the things he was talking about, what he was going to do, he was the one that kind of was leading the way with this, hey, let's shake things up. And so I said, you know, I think that looks like a lot of fun. And so after I told him, yeah, I'd be interested in doing that, several editors called me up, you know, would you be interested in this? And Axel Alonso called me up, and we had a few ideas, and then he said, you know, I'm kind of embarrassed to say this, but one of the things I'm doing, you might be interested in, don't hate me for suggesting this, but X-Force? And I was like, well, give me the skinny on that. What exactly are you looking at? And he says, well, we're completely starting from scratch. All new characters. And Peter Milligan is going to write it. And I was like, whoa, wait, stop right there. So I'll be working with Peter Milligan, and we get to create all new characters. He said, yep, that's it. That's the one.
Yep.
And as we were on the phone, I started doodling characters, one of which was Dupe, this blobby guy. And so I immediately sent this scratch paper of doodles to him with character names and designs and stuff, and a word balloon over the one weird looking character that said Dupe, and kind of like Homer Simpson's Dupe.
Yeah.
So and he was like, yeah, a lot of these look really promising except for this Dupe guy. I don't think anybody's going to take that seriously. And then a few days later, you know, I got in the loop with Peter, and we started germinating ideas. It started coming together really fast, and I just had this tidal wave of character ideas and costume ideas and power ideas, just which was good because Peter's intention was to build the super team and kill them off in the very first issue. So it was like, okay, wait, let me hang on to my favorite ones before you kill them all off. And so there was that, but then Axel called up and said, okay, I don't know what the deal is, but I pinned up your sketches in the hallway, and everybody's running around the halls of Marvel yelling, Dupe, Dupe. And so he thought, you know, we may have something here. This could be Marvel's Mickey Mouse, you know. So it just kind of took off from there, and Dupe became a member of the team and became the most mysterious, powerful character in the group. At the same time, I also, one of my favorite characters was Mr. Sensitive, who is literally the brother of one of my Atomics characters named Adam Bomb. They have the same skin affliction. And so it was fun to kind of like subversively have the brother of a creator-owned character in this Marvel book. And he became one of the more popular characters too, to my great joy.
Yep.
And so it really was a great time. And that first issue, I didn't realize how violent it was. It was just following the script, because I'm a big monster movie fan, and I think I'm a sensitive guy, but I guess not sensitive.
You're not Mr. Sensitive.
I'm not Mr. Sensitive, because I was shocked when there was this, oh no, what do we do?
Yeah.
And Joe was like, okay, you know, because the Comics Code Authority rejected it, and Joe was like, he thought, you know, that's an outdated system. Let's just dump it.
Yeah.
And so that first issue we did became the book that killed the Comics Code.
Yep.
I don't know if I should be proud of that or ashamed of that, but you know, I'm about, you know, artists should be able to do what they want to do, and the audience determines whether it's to their taste or not. So that was a really powerful beginning for us, and it was launched in they like relaunched almost all of the X books that same month.
Yep.
So it was great being part of that and going out with that group, because, you know, there's Frank Quitely and Grant Morrison, who we were hanging out with and doing panels with. And I was able to do a jam cover with Frank Quitely. He's one of my favorite artists. Yeah. I like him a lot. There's just one good memory after another. It's around that time that Darwin Cook became one of my best friends, because he we're doing Catwoman together, and he asked if he could do some X-Force stuff. And I said, you bet. He kind of became our go-to guy on X-Force, and came out to stay with us. So from there, that experience, I got one of the best friends I've ever had in my life. So it's all good, and always got to do what we wanted to. And then, of course, the tail end of that, this is the quick story, the quick version. Peter had this amazing idea to bring Princess Diana back as a Marvel mutant superhero. Having those words coming out of my mouth, I realize how people got upset. But this script that he wrote was so respectful and affectionate.
Yeah.
At least that's how I read it. And I worked really hard. I penciled the first three issues, you know, working hard on her likeness, finding this idealized superhero version of her. And I still haven't heard exactly what happened, but a few feelings got hurt, and apparently someone involved with Buckingham Palace or influential or concerned, I still don't know exactly what, but somebody squashed it and was like, this, we can't have this. And and of course it was someone that never saw the script, never saw what we intended to do with it. But for whatever reason, we were told we can't do this. And it just kind of kicked the air out of me personally. I won't speak for Peter, but I just didn't have the heart to redraw it.
Yep.
And so fortunately, Jay Bone is a mutual friend of Darwin and I. Came on and redrew the Diana and did the inking. And then Nick Crane came on to do the inking for me. And I really didn't have, I couldn't muster up inking again until I think the last issue was the next time I inked again. And to be fair, Marvel was really great with us. I mean, they spoiled us rotten, so it's their own fault. And they tried to make it up to us by doing this big Avengers crossover, mm-hmm. which for me as a fan was a huge thrill. And so it ended on a really strong, positive note. And but yeah, you know, that was a real tough thing to.
Yeah.
I've been spoiled for so long. It was kind of hard to be told no.
Yeah.
But nothing but love for those people. It was a great time, and I have nothing but great memories with that one exception.
Yep.
And recently, Peter and Axel and I, Peter's got an idea for another story, and so we may bring those characters back for something.
That's excellent. Now, going back, I guess, you're saying you're going back to maybe doing something like that. You've been back on Madman for a little bit, and Image is putting that book out. Awesome job. You've had a couple of good compilations coming out of the collections. But the one issue I want to talk to you about is number three. Obviously, a very easy book for you to draw. Tell us a little bit about the whole process. You had every panel you did in a different style of a famous artist. And I would love to know where that came from and how painstakingly just nuts was it to try to get this done.
It's kind of something I guess I always wanted to do, even if I didn't consciously know that. Madman for me is like my home planet. It's where I can do absolutely anything I want. It's the perfect umbrella title for me, where there's no rules.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll go off on these little detours now and again, but I always come back knowing that I'm going to go back to my home planet.
Yep.
And play with Madman again. So with this latest series, Madman Atomic Comics, I thought, I'm just going to do anything I want. No rules.
Yep.
And all of these different experiments that I'd kind of accumulated and wanted an opportunity to play with, different techniques, storytelling techniques, yep. art techniques, this was going to be my series to do that. And so almost every issue of the series, I'm finishing issue 16 now, almost every issue has a different experiment or technique or something that I've tried differently. Issue 9, for instance, is one gigantic panel.
Yep.
But with issue number 3, being a fan and having my influences, I've been really blessed and lucky to where, like, I think over 125 of my favorite artists have drawn their version of Madman, and they've been published as bubblegum cards and
yeah.
pinup books and a big, nice, you know, hardcover book. That's been a big thrill for me. But as fans, when we're first starting out, we always want to, oh, I wish I could draw like him, or I wish I could draw like her, or I wish I could do that. And so I thought, well, I'll try that. And so I came up with this story where his reality is constantly shifting. And so from panel to panel, I'm able to take an artist from my childhood or one of my contemporaries that I admire and really just break down their style and do my utmost best to capture their style via Madman and this character that's kind of walking him through these different realities.
Yes.
And so I just kind of made this master list and started breaking down the story. You know, what artist should I try to draw like for each moment in the story? And it just went with that. So everyone from like Charles Schultz to Dr. Yep. Seuss, you know, Charles Adams, Jack Kirby, Frank Frazetta, you know, it just goes on and on.
And it must have been a lot of fun, but at the same time, pretty painstaking.
I thought it would be easy that, you know, hey, I'm just copying.
Yeah.
You know, so I'll just be, but to try to really nail the style took a lot more work than I thought it would. And I actually went as far as to try to find out what kind of pens they use or what kind of brushes they used. And like the James Jean one, for instance, who uses different textures and stuff. I had to try to replicate those textures. And or Al Hirschfeld, you know, what kind of, he used like a dip pen, which I have next to no experience with. I had to go out and buy the pen that he used, and to try to make that panel as authentic as possible. So here I was trying to do a monthly book, and issue 3, I think, took me close to 4 months. So it put me a little behind.
But it was definitely worth reading. I had so much fun looking at it and dissecting it, putting a little checklist together to see, okay, I think that's who this guy's supposed to be, and this guy, yep, that's who it is. And I had so much fun, and I'm sure the fans did as well, so I know we all appreciate it.
Yeah, some of the panels towards the end was like, oh, I can't get everybody I want in here. So I actually started making amalgam panels where I would try to merge styles and then just, you know, had him merging back into his own reality. So there were still at least like 20 artists that I would have liked to have gotten in there. And not that I would do it again, but if I were to do it, if I knew then what I know now, it would have been a double size issue. And it would have been 100% satisfying instead of 90% is what it is now.
Yeah.
But I'm really happy with it. I love the reaction that it got. And it's original art I'll never let go of.
Yeah.
It was great.
Well, you got a lot of people lining up to come talk to you again. I don't want to take up too much time, any more time. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for coming back to New England. It's great to have you here. And continued success on everything that you're doing.
Thanks. We'll try not to be strangers.
There we go. And so ends yet another Creator Spotlight. So on behalf of Brian, who's wandering around the show somewhere, this is the Matt Man. Have yourself a good one.
And we are back to round out our final retrospective episode with an interview that I think I could not do a top 10 list without.
Yeah.
And that is Mr. Anthony Johnston. Now, Anthony, as we've talked about before, was pretty much our first real creator interview. And the very first interview that we did with him was us emailing questions to him and him recording the answers to. And the audio quality wasn't that great. But we became good friends after that. Mm-hmm. Anthony, of course, is the creator of Wasteland.
Yep.
He had put quotes from Secret Identity in our early days on some of the early issues of Wasteland.
Yeah, first press.
He has done work on Daredevil. He has done work. He did the Wolverine Prodigal Son graphic novel. He has worked on the Dead Space series. And the interview that we talk about today, which is from issue number 117.5, I believe hits on a few of those different topics, because in the early days, we really talked about Wasteland primarily. And now it's doing so many different things, and he's so involved. Dead Space became such an amazing franchise, and he's really got his fingerprints all over that franchise. And then you talk about the Wolverine stuff he did, which was a manga book that was really a departure from what people knew of Wolverine, and it was kind of a risk. And then you talk about the work that he did with Daredevil during the whole Shadowland thing. I mean, he's doing so many different things, but always a super nice guy to talk to. He's a metal fan.
Yep, and a Genesis fan, too.
And a huge Lovecraft fan. In fact, I always send him, anytime the Lovecraft Society is updating their movie, Whisperer in the Darkness, I'm always emailing, did you see the new trailer for this? Did you see this? And he always emails me back. He's just a super nice guy. A good friend of our friend, Mr. Dan Evans.
Yes.
But just all-around great guy, and someone who has been sort of like milestone interviews along the years. Like every year and a half or so, we'll sit down and talk to Anthony, and we're due for another one. So in the next incarnation of Secret Identity, we'll be talking to him again to catch up on everything that's new. But just a fantastic guy, and another guy that I'm proud to know.
Hopefully we will be meeting him at some show very soon.
Love to see him at New York Comic Con.
Yep.
And I think he was there last year, and we never ended up connecting.
Actually, he didn't come out.
Oh, he didn't. Okay.
Yeah, he didn't come out.
Because that would have been really sad. So
yeah.
So yeah, but a great interview. So that's going to wrap up the third retrospective episode of Secret Identity. We are officially closing the book.
It is done. Snap.
On Secret Identity. The next time you hear the podcast after this, it will be our brand new show. And it will be both familiar, but with a new car smell, with like one of those little pine things that you get when you go through the car wash.
Yeah, it's not going to be like Battlestar Galactica 1980.
Right.
It's going to be better.
It's going to be better than that. So there you go. This is Brian Letenry signing off.
And the Matt Man.
Have a wonderful rest of your week, and we will see you all new very soon.
Bye-bye.
And this is Brian here, and I am here with someone who was our very first interview ever on Secret Identity about 2 years ago, and that's Mr. Anthony Johnston. How you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. Was I really the first?
You were really the first, and we're actually going to talk about that in a few moments when we start talking about Wasteland, because I think it was your approach to not only us, but just to podcasters in general that really made a big splash back then. And I don't want to flatter you and gush all over you in the beginning of the interview, but I will tell you that you were very influential in the early stages of Secret Identity. So, yes, very first interview we ever did.
Wow. Well, thank you.
So let's jump right in and talk about Wasteland, because I would say for our listeners, Wasteland is immediately recognizable for them. That's a comic that we've talked about since the start of the show, and it's something that has become very critically acclaimed over the past couple of years. Give us a quick update about Wasteland. How has this ride been for you? You guys are up to issue 17 now, and what can we look forward to in the coming months from Wasteland?
Well, it certainly has been a ride. It's it's been a real roller coaster. It's been a hell of an education for me, actually. The last you say the last 2 years. That's its publishing history. But obviously with preparatory work and what have you, it's actually been about 3 years since we started on the project, and it's been a real education and a real roller coaster. You know, it's the first ongoing monthly series that I've done, and it is. So it's one of those things, I heard people say this before I started it, and it's one of those things where you hear it and you think, yeah, but it's absolutely true. Until you write an open-ended, ongoing monthly series, you cannot understand what it's like to do so. Do you know what I mean? There's nothing that will prepare you for it. It's completely different to writing miniseries or graphic novels. So yeah, it's been a real journey and a real roller coaster. And I have to say, thank you. To you, especially to yourselves, but also to all the other people, the podcasters out there that have interviewed myself and Chris and supported Wasteland, because, you know, as I'm sure you know, an indie book really needs that sort of support. And it's been great for us. We really, really appreciate it. So, we're up to, 17 was published a few weeks ago. 18 will be published soon, in a couple of weeks, maybe 2-3 weeks. Although I'm actually up to writing issue 22 at the moment. So what can you look forward to? 18 and 19, the next two issues to be published, are the end of the current arc, the sort of Battle of New Begin arc. And what you can look forward to in there is the climax of the battle, obviously. A few more twists and turns in the story of Ariyasi. And Marcus especially. You can look for some. You can look forward to some more backstabbing, a few more betrayals, some politics, Dexus, Watchman Dexus. Things don't quite work out the way he planned, but then they don't really work out the way that's for Scott that he planned them either. There are a lot of surprises in store for both of those characters. Big surprise in store for Primate Hedor as well, and of course his son Yan, and we'll be dealing with the consequences of that further down the line. So yeah, that's the end of that arc, and then issue 20 is another of our interlude issues, and we have Chuck Beebe, incredible young artist, really, really individual, unique artist. He did the Black Metal graphic novel from Oni, which came out last year, which is one of my favourites of last year, just because I'm a big metalhead, as I'm sure your regular listeners will know, and regular readers of Wasteland come to that. And he is the guest artist for that issue, but he's sharing responsibilities with Chris. Chris will be doing a few pages for issue 20, and then Chuck will be doing the rest. I'm not sure if it's actually been solicited yet or not, but it's going to tell the story. I won't say the true story, because what is the truth? But it tells the story anyway of Marcus's founding of New Begin. We finally get to hear the story in full, at least as it's told to the city, to the residents of the city. But is it the truth? Is it real? You know, can he be trusted? We don't know. And, you know, some of the characters in the story will be questioning that as well. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm really looking forward to seeing what Chuck does with it, because he really is a brilliant artist. And we're going to do something a bit different with the format as well. But I don't want to give anything away. So that should be fun. And then after that, we have the next story arc, which is called Dog Tribe, the story arc as a whole. Issue 21 is Dogs of War. And again, I don't want to give too much away, but of course, we know that Michael and Abby have already left the city. We know that they managed to escape the city. And so they're on their way, they're on their continuing the quest to find Ariase. And this arc will basically be the first step in that journey. And we'll introduce a new social group, a new nomad tribe in the world of Wasteland, who are called the Dog Tribes. And that'll be pretty interesting. It's fun to write. I'm literally only just started writing it. It starts with 21, and I'm writing 22 at the moment. But it's fun. It's fun to get back to Michael and Abby again, obviously, you know, our two sort of principal characters. So it's fun to get, yeah, back in their heads and follow their journey again. And you know, have a bit of wisecracking from both of them, but it's also I'm quite happy with how the story itself is coming out so far as well, because it's another you know, I've tried to do this with every arc. It's another glimpse into yet another facet of the world of Wasteland, and another way to look at the world, the way, and another different way that the world is seen through the eyes of a different social group, like it was with the caravans, like it has been with, you know, obviously the people of Providence compared to New Begin and so on. So, yeah, lots of things coming up, lots of things in store. And we have something very special coming up for issue 25. But that's all I'm going to say at the moment. I'll talk to you again about that closer to the time, if you like.
Well, we look forward to that. And I'll tell you, I was thinking the other day about Wasteland and trying to think of any other comic that sort of captures what you're doing in there. And to me, it's easy to tell a story about the apocalypse. There's so many movies out there and there's so many books out there that cover the event that sort of changes the world. And I think the more difficult thing, and you were talking about the challenges of doing an ongoing series, to me the more difficult thing is to talk about, well, what happens after that? And not only what happens after that, but what happens to how people live and how they act and the way that they used to be and the way that they are now. And the only other book that I think that even does anything like what you're doing with Wasteland is The Walking Dead. I see both of those books in a very interesting light because they focus on what happens after the apocalypse and how people are changed because of it and how people still have to move forward and live and sort of deal with politics and religion and interpersonal relationships set against this backdrop. And it's just fascinating.
Well, and I agree. I mean, to be honest, to me, that's the more interesting part. I mean, you know, I love a good end of the world movie or what have you as much as the next person. But to me, the interesting part about post-apocalyptic fiction is after the apocalypse, you know, post-apocalyptic. That's the core of it. And that to me is what's interesting to look at from, you know, from a writer's point of view, to really sort of build the world and try and, yeah, think, as you say, think about how people are going to survive, how people will live, the politics and the religion that will come into play and all that. I mean, I've spoken about this before. That to me is the really interesting part. So, I don't know. I mean, in my own mind, it doesn't really feel that Wasteland is all that unique. But then, you know, maybe I'm too close to it. It's hard to say. All I know is that it's the story I want to tell, and I'm very fortunate to be able to tell it in the way I want to tell, and have people enjoy it, which is a stunning to me that so many people seem to enjoy it as well as me, because I really am writing it for myself. Because I think you have to, especially with a book that's this personal. You really just have to write it for yourself, you know, with yourself as the sort of audience, prime audience that you have in mind. So the fact that there are so many people out there who obviously sort of share this taste is brilliant. And yeah, I'm just really glad that I have the opportunity to sort of get into this part that, as I say, to me is the most interesting aspect of post-apocalyptic fiction.
Well, and I think you cannot discount the fact that people have really come to like you as a creator behind this book. And I think a lot of that has to do with the way that you've handled Wasteland from day one. And I, you know, talked in the beginning about how you were Secret Identity's first interview, but we just happened to be launching somewhere around the time in the first several months as you were getting ready to put the book out, and you had done what I thought was an absolutely brilliant grassroots marketing campaign to a lot of the comic blogs and a lot of the podcast sites that were out there to get people to start talking about your book. And I feel like even now, 2 years later, there are so few creators, and unfortunately not enough indie creators, that get that. And so to me, the way that you've put yourself out there with this book and with your website and everything else from the start of this has really given people sort of a window into you. You talked about being a metalhead a few minutes ago and things like that. I think people are loyal to this book in a lot of ways because they feel like they are getting to know you through that. And so can you just talk a little bit about that decision when you were launching Wasteland to go for that grassroots marketing campaign? Because I think that was brilliant and not enough people do that now.
Well, I would agree that unfortunately not enough people do it. To be honest with you, it was a pretty difficult decision for me to make. You know, I'm English. That sort of sets the mood for everything. This isn't the sort of thing that I normally do. I'm not a relentless self-marketer. I'm quite sort of, I won't say shy, but, you know, I don't sort of go out there and loudly shout about how brilliant I am from the rooftops and stuff. It's really not sort of my natural disposition. But having been in indie comics for long enough at the point where we were launched Wasteland, to know that you have to do that to an extent, especially with indie books. I decided that it was kind of now or never. You know, Wasteland, excuse me, as I say, Wasteland was my first ongoing series. So I kind of realized that, you know, this is a very personal book to me. I desperately wanted the book at least to survive. You know, success is relative, especially, as I say, in the indie world. But, you know, more than anything, I wanted to make sure that if the book did tank, it wasn't because of a lack of effort on my part to let people know that it existed and hopefully find people who shared that taste that I mentioned earlier with me and wanted to read this sort of story. So it was a kind of, you know, I had to make the decision and I just decided to go all out. I mean, you know, some people might say that I didn't go far enough, but to me, and certainly compared to how I'd been in the past, it was a pretty intense marketing campaign. And obviously, yeah, we still, you know, I still do interviews like this. I'm happy to do stuff like this, obviously. But we also still do we have the mailing list, we do the website. You know, I do the soundtrack, the music for Wasteland. All that stuff is not that I don't enjoy doing it, because I do. I wouldn't do it if I didn't. But it is all part of, this sort of, you know, keeping it in people's minds and keeping the title sort of, you know, keeping attention focused on it, if you like. And so it is something that I think will just never end until the book ends. It is something that you have to get out there and you have to do constantly. You can't just sort of make a few press releases on, you know, the comic news blogs and then forget about it for the next year, because people will forget about it, especially in this day and age of, you know, the internet and short attention spans and what have you, and I'm as guilty of that as anyone. You can't do that. People will forget about you if you don't remind them, you know, subtly or not, but if you don't remind them somehow every so often that you're still there, you're still publishing, and you're still producing what you hope is, you know, a good book worth reading, people will forget about you if you don't do that. So it's just one of the things that you have to do. And as I say, to me, it's primarily just because for Wasteland particularly, it is such a personal book for me, and something that I so desperately want to do and see through to completion that I would kick myself if, you know, we tanked, if we got cancelled because of low sales or something. And it was because I hadn't done all I could to bring the book to the attention of people who might want to read it. So it's a kind of, you know, it really was a pragmatic decision. But I agree with you that more people really should do it. It's something that, I'm still not particularly comfortable about, you know, really massively hyping things and shouting from the rooftops. But I've just learned to accept it as part of the job, you know, when you're in indie comics specifically, because obviously if you're doing mainstream books, you know, the sites come to you and the hits and the news and what have you. Everybody looks for you because that's the news. But when you're an indie book and you're struggling for attention, you just have to do it. And as I say, I've just come to accept it as part of the job, really, of working in this field. It's one of the trade-offs against being able to do the book that I want to do.
Well, and I think a lot of the fans also have to recognize and hopefully support the fact that when you're working on an indie book and you're pushing it and you're doing all the marketing yourself, that is just exponentially more and more effort that has to go into the book in addition to writing the book and putting it together and plotting it out. So, you know, people should definitely respect that. I know that we have a lot of respect for the work that the indie people put into their books, and especially you guys with the marketing that you're doing. And we've just talked about Wasteland for 15 minutes now. If that was the only thing that you were doing, that would still be a huge amount of work. But you've got some other projects that are going on right now and that are coming up in the next several months. The first one I wanted to talk about was the one that is based on an upcoming video game that's coming out from EA this Halloween, and that is Dead Space. Can you tell us a little bit about the premise for Dead Space? Because you are doing the prequel series in comic form that is leading up to the game's launch.
That's right, yeah. Do you mean the premise of the game or the premise of the comic, or both?
Well, let's start with the comic, because from what I've seen from the game so far, things have moved along pretty quickly by the time you get to the game. So let's talk about what's happening in the prequel comic.
Okay, well, the idea behind the comic is basically, it is a prequel, and it is a complete, it's not a sort of, it's not one of these prequels that's kind of unrelated and just happens to tell you, you know, some story about the character from the game in a different, you know, in a previous job or something. It is a true prequel. The comic basically deals with the 5 weeks on the colony of Aegis VII, the mining colony, which is, you know, around which the game is set. It tells you of the 5 weeks that lead up to the start of the game. Where the comic ends, literally the last panel of the last page of the comic, is pretty much where the game will start in terms of the timeline. But because of the nature of the game and the nature of the prequel story, it is also completely separate, and it also stands on its own. That was something that we were very, well, I personally was very sort of keen on doing, quite excited to do, because, you know, I don't want to name names, but we've all seen a whole bunch of shitty video game spin-off comics, and I've done a fair few adaptations and spin-offs myself, and I'm always pretty militant about making sure that they work as comics on their own, so that somebody can read the comic without ever knowing anything about the video game and still get, you know, a good read out of it. So what we have in the prequel is a whole new cast of characters. There are a few scenes and a few lines and a few sort of things that happen that are linked directly into the game. But the majority of it, not to say that it stands completely apart, because it's all part of the game's background, but it's separate in that way that you don't need to have read the comic to understand the game. You don't need to play the game to understand the comic. So that was the sort of reason for doing it. And what the comic basically shows is there's a mining colony set in the far future where Earth's resources are so spent, but space travel has progressed far enough that the best solution to the energy problem is simply to find dead planets and literally rip them apart for their resources. So you have quite literally a planet, you know, maybe half the size of Earth or something, that's just dead. It's just, you know, a rock floating in space. And they take these enormous, like, mile-long ships called planet crackers to this place, and they literally crack the planet into pieces and then mine all those pieces for the ore and the minerals and what have you. And that's how they've solved the energy crisis. Pretty drastic approach, but, you know, it works. And so the story focuses on a mining colony. They do all the preparatory work before the big ship comes in, you know, preparing the planet to be cracked, as they say. And as I say, these planets are all supposed to be dead, but 5 weeks before the planet crack is due to take place, and before the ship has even arrived, the mining colony, which has been there 2.5 years, suddenly on one of their geological survey digs, discovers a strange alien artifact. Well, I say alien, a strange artifact, and they conclude that it must be alien, because it certainly isn't, you know, doesn't look like anything from Earth. And this planet is supposed to be dead. Nobody's ever visited it before. You know, what the hell is this thing doing here? And it causes pandemonium on the colony, partly because it very, very closely resembles something called the Black Marker, which is the symbol of a small minority religious cult on Earth which is all centered around a previous discovery of a supposed alien artifact that was allegedly hushed up by the government and only brought to light by a whistleblower who then died in mysterious circumstances, and a whole cult built up around this man and his claims. But it's still very much a minority cult. However, they soon discover that this minority cult, it also has, you know, is represented on the colony. And the discovery of the artifact puts the followers of the cult called Unitology at odds with the rest of the colony, you know, who are all just sort of not cultists. And in addition to that, people start having psychological problems. The colony's doctor is mystified as to why people are suddenly depressed and can't sleep, and people start having hallucinations. And it's all, I mean, you know, it's all building up to something very bad happening. I don't think it's giving away too much to say that. And so we really just follow the 5 weeks from the discovery of the artifact to the point where the game starts, and show the disintegration of the colony, really, and how much sort of how much damage the discovery of this artifact does. And also, you know, it's very much a character study as well. We follow a lot of different characters throughout the colony, everybody's different reactions to it. And part of that is so that we can show how, even in the far future, you know, people are still people, and there is politics, and there is, you know, sort of corporate politics especially, and there is greed, and there are, you know, personality clashes, and there are religious clashes and what have you. And it's very much a sort of a study of how things can go badly very, very quickly, you know, if the circumstances are right or wrong, as the case may be.
Well, and what I love about this book, and I'm a huge horror fan, and I know that you're a huge horror fan as well, so this to me is right up my alley. It's leading up to a game that I was already excited about, but I love the depth that you've added to the story, and it has some parallels to other works that you've done, Wasteland most notably, in that you like to play with the theme of religion and sort of religious prosecution and people's belief systems and how that affects their relationships. And, you know, we see it with the Sunners in Wasteland, and we're seeing it here with Unitology here. And as you mentioned, sort of when things go bad and how certain events can just bring people's relationships to the extreme. That to me jumped right out at me when I was reading this book. So is that a core theme for you that you like to explore in all the stuff that you do?
It's not actually. It's really just a sort of strange coincidence. I mean, it's a central part of Wasteland because I firmly believe that if, you know, in the event of something like a huge apocalypse, as it was in sort of, you know, pre-technological times, religion would be a very central part of people's lives, and new myths and legends would spring up because people always look for answers. And, you know, they will often, especially if they're not technologically advanced or educated, they will often look for, you know, mythological answers to their questions. So that's why it's a big part of Wasteland, just because it's sort of inbuilt into the world, or the way I see the post-apocalyptic world. With Dead Space, it was a part of the game background. It wasn't something that I put in there. It was something that, you know, the game designers had already decided would be a central tenet of the story, and so it's really just coincidence that that they both happen to feature, yeah, this same sort of theme of religious persecution and, you know, people searching for faith and what have you. But it is an interesting tack to take, and it makes for a very interesting story in Dead Space, and it will feature in the game as well. You know, it's not something that's dealt with an awful lot in video games. I mean, video games as art, the concept's been around forever, but, you know, it's really, there aren't that many out there that sort of, you know, get that much to grips with their story. It's something that I've railed about in the past. Excuse me. And one of the things that attracted me to working on Dead Space was that there is a hell of a lot of emphasis on story. You know, the guys had done a lot of preparatory work before I became involved, and they've done 10 times as much again since I became involved and we started doing the comic and what have you. And I've also written the dialogue script for the game as well. So, you know, we've had a lot of discussion about story and what have you, and obviously EA has been the main driving force, but they have taken on board, you know, feedback from myself and from other people that they've brought in, to try and make this the best story they possibly can. And that's really just all we're trying to do with the comic as well. You know, we just want to make it the best comic to go with the game that we can, in the same way that they want to make the game the best video game they can. So, yeah, as I say, that theme, it's not a kind of pet theme of mine. It is interesting. I find it very interesting. But it's not something, if you actually look back at my, you know, previous stuff, it's not something that really comes up before Wasteland at all. And it is just coincidence that that it happens to be in two books that are being published simultaneously now.
Well, and you kind of answered one of my other questions, which was, you know, how much of the parameters of the world had they defined before you guys started the comic and for the game? And it sounds like they've really put a lot of depth into, you know, just trying to create a really good story. And one of the things that I loved when I saw the trailer for the game is it's really kind of a love letter to so many of the great horror movies and just influences in the genre that we've seen before. You've obviously got your Lovecraftian references in some of the creature design. You've got, I think, some huge John Carpenter references just in the music from the game, and it certainly evokes things like The Thing. I saw a little bit of Event Horizon in there, which I thought was one of the overlooked kind of space horror movies of the last generation. It seems to be taking some of the best elements of some of the best movies and stories that we've had over the years and bringing them into a game, which as a horror, I don't want to say connoisseur, but certainly a horror aficionado, it just pumps me up seeing that. And then the comic leading into it is providing a great backstory. So you, I would imagine, as a horror fan, must just be eating this up as well.
Oh, totally, yeah. And you're absolutely right. You know, there are massive homages and, you know, sort of influences on the game from all of those places, because all of the kind of core team, certainly everyone that I've met, you know, the producers and the story editors and the sound guys and what have you, are all huge horror fans and big sci-fi fans. I mean, you know, video gaming and sci-fi kind of goes together. But these guys are all big horror fans as well. Yeah, I mean, there are influences from John Carpenter. There are influences from things like Event Horizon and Alien and Aliens and Lovecraft, yeah. And it is, you know, full of those sort of little homages and influences and little touches. And I wrote some into the game script as well. You know, there are a few little references here and there. Because I think you have to. I think you have to recognize when you're doing something like that, you're going to be compared to those sorts of things, you know, if you're doing that kind of visual style especially. And so I think you have to acknowledge them. I did the same thing in Wasteland. I said this in my column in the very, very first issue. You have to acknowledge those influences. There's absolutely no point in trying to deny them or trying to sort of brush them under the carpet, because anybody with half a brain will see them. You know, you have to acknowledge them. And it's the right thing to do, to say, actually, yeah, these things are pretty cool. And, you know, maybe you haven't read this particular book. Maybe you haven't seen this particular movie. And you should, you know, because we think it's so cool that we've taken something from it and, you know, kind of incorporated it into this new thing that we're doing. And that's the same in both the game and the comic. You know, I do that all the time in comics. And these guys are doing it again with the game. It is pretty cool. It's been a lot of fun to work on. And the guys at EA, I have to say that the guys at EA have been exceedingly cool to work with. It's been a lot less hassle than I thought it would be. You know, this is, EA are probably the biggest licensor that I've worked directly with. And, you know, you always expect these things to be a bumpy ride, but it's actually been really smooth. There haven't been any sort of major upsets. We're all kind of on the same wavelength. You know, we have, as I say, we have long discussions about story and all that sort of thing. And it's just gone really well. And I think that shows in the comic, because they've trusted me a lot with the comic. There's a lot of stuff in the comic where, you know, a lot of other licensors would have said, oh, well, we're not sure about that. Oh, well, you know, can you do this? Can you do that? I mean, you know, we're, I think the third issue came out in the stands a few weeks ago.
Yep.
And we still haven't seen the aliens. Yeah, right. This is a six-issue miniseries. We're halfway through. We still haven't actually seen the aliens. So, and I think that takes a lot of trust. I think that shows how willing EA are to sort of bring people like myself and Ben on board and say, we want to make a comic. We don't know how to make a comic, but you know how to make a comic. So please go away and make a good comic for us, and we'll trust you to do that. And that's exactly what we've done, to the best of our ability. And they really have trusted us with that. And I think that's worth, you know, worth mentioning and worth recognizing, because there's a lot of people that would have been on, you know, on the phone to me immediately going, why aren't there any aliens? We're in issue 3 yet, you know. So, yeah, it's been a really interesting and fun experience.
Well, and I think that's very evident in the comic, because you can smell, as you mentioned before, in some of those video game tie-ins, you can smell a mile away when the creator has sort of got the handcuffs on, or they're being told. It's just like you can see it in the movies too, when sort of marketing and people who aren't familiar with the genre are tinkering with what the creator really wants to do, and you don't see that in this book, because as you mentioned, one big thing is you haven't seen the aliens yet, but I think also in just the themes that you're exploring and the interactions between the characters, it feels standalone, it feels genuine, and it's only going to help lend credibility to the game, I think, because people are not seeing it as a cheap tie-in. So that's awesome, and it's great to hear that the process went well too.
Well, and the funny thing is that actually the comic is sort of the department that is dealing with the comic is actually marketing. You know, we're kind of, the comic is an offshoot of the marketing department. It's just that everybody in the marketing department is a huge horror fan as well, so which is great. So it kind of goes back to what you were saying before about, you know, how evident it is that everybody on is, you know, that is full of horror influences. And, yeah, even the marketing department are all huge horror movie buffs. So, yeah, not your average marketing team.
No, and that bodes well for, obviously, for the comic, as we're seeing now, and for the game. So that we've kind of covered Dead Space, let's talk about another project that was just recently announced. And this one is a little bit of a ways off, but you are currently working on a manga book, in fact, based on Wolverine, that's supposed to come out in June of 2009. I know you can't talk a lot about it, but could you just give us a quick snippet of how that's going so far?
It's going very well. I was approached by Del Rey Manga to basically, as you may have read on the news, they have the license from Marvel to publish manga versions of Wolverine and the X-Men. And I was approached to see if I would be interested in doing the Wolverine manga. And the idea is that it is literally a reinvention. You know, we're taking the sort of the core of the character, and this is the same in the X-Men one as well, but obviously I'm not as familiar with that. But certainly with Wolverine, we're really taking sort of the core of the character, you know, what is, strip him down to his core, and what is Wolverine. And then rebuilding it up in a manga context. So, you know, the book is very much written as if it were a manga, you know. It's written as a manga, it is a manga, you know. Yeah, I'm not Japanese, but I'm writing it as a manga and in the manga style. The artwork is from a guy called Wilson Tortosa, who has done Tomb Raider and Battle of the Planets previously. And it's superb, really. I mean, it's not copycat manga artwork. He's not a guy who's just learned how to draw by reading Sailor Moon or what have you. It is very much his own style, but there are huge manga influences in there as well, you can see. And he has a very dynamic, energetic, and exciting style to his artwork. It's really, really fun to see the pages come back. I can't really talk too much about the story, unfortunately. But what I can tell you is that we have taken Wolverine, as I say, sort of stripped down the essentials, and then rebuilt him up in a manga book. This is not the Wolverine you recognize. This is not the Logan that you will be familiar with from the past 30 years or whatever it is of Marvel books. It really is almost an entirely new character, but, you know, sort of in terms of his environment and his world, but the character, the core of the character, you know, the essential things that make him Wolverine are still very much in evidence. That's been a lot of fun. I was a little unsure when I was first approached. I thought, well, am I really the right person to do this? But I've had so much fun with it, and I think it's come out so well that, I think actually that was quite canny of Del Rey to sort of, you know, maybe see that I had the potential to do that. It's been a lot of fun. I look forward to talking more about it when I can, but unfortunately, because Del Rey obviously are a book publisher, so they work on a completely different time scale, and they have very different, you know, sort of marketing and PR methods compared to a comics company. And because the launch of the book is still so far away, you know, a year away, they're being very canny and very cagey about what they're releasing to the public. So as I say, unfortunately, even though I'm actually writing the end of the first volume, it'll be a two-volume series, and I'm actually writing the end of the first volume right now, but unfortunately I can't talk about the story yet, but I promise to do so closer to the time when I'm allowed.
Well, that's fine, because now you've just given us another excuse to come back and talk to you again about stuff, so we'll definitely talk more about that in the future. And before I let you go, as we're nearing 40 minutes now of your very late past your bedtime time, can I just get a quick update on Texas Strangers? Because a lot of our listeners really enjoyed the first few issues that came out of that. And, you know, we obviously are big fans of that book. So I know that it's kind of not in the same format that it was before. But what can you tell us about the future of Texas Strangers?
Well, the future of Texas Strangers is very much uncertain, unfortunately. If you visit the Texas Strangers blog, I did put a post up there recently explaining all this. Basically, the book simply wasn't viable, if you like, in the format that it was in as it stood. It simply, you know, it was hemorrhaging readers, money, left, right and centre. We simply couldn't continue in the, you know, as we were, unfortunately. And it was kind of bad timing as well. If we had a bit more sense, we probably wouldn't have launched it when we did, because two of the two other main principal creators, both Dan and Mario, both had small children, like at or around the time that we launched Texas Strangers, which really, you know, I'm sure anybody who's been a parent knows that the first 6 to 12 months especially are, you know, you don't really have a lot of time for anything other than dealing with your child. So that really didn't help. It was very, you know, bad timing on our part, really, maybe naivety. And yeah, it was primarily, unfortunately, that we just couldn't seem to get it into enough hands. Everybody we know that read the book loved it. All the kids that we know loved it. We know that it's a good book. We know that kids like it and that there is an audience for it. We just couldn't find them. We couldn't get the book into their hands, unfortunately. And so we had to cancel it. We just simply didn't have a choice. So we do want to tell the rest of the story. We want to continue it. We want to carry on. But we don't know at the moment what the best way is to do that. We don't know who would be willing to publish it. Yeah, you know, we're looking at our options. We do want to carry on. We do want to do more. We do want to finish the story. But how that will come about, unfortunately, at the moment, we simply don't know. All I can say is, you know, as I said, we do very much want to finish it. And we really want to, you know, allow people to read the rest of it and follow the story. But unfortunately, at the time, we just simply don't know what the best way is to do that. And so we're still looking around for answers.
Well, you know, here's hoping that you find them, because I think that the concept that you guys came up with for Texas Strangers is brilliant. And for kids, it's something that there's nothing out there like that right now. It speaks for me to my old days, my roots as a D&D player, but also, you know, being a fan of the Wild West. And I think it is a really strong property that, who knows, hopefully you guys will find a way to carry that on, whether it be webcomic, print form. You know, maybe we'll even see a Texas Strangers cartoon someday, because I think it would lend itself brilliantly to the animated form as well. So it's disappointing for now, but I'm glad that you guys are sticking with it, and hopefully we haven't heard the last of Texas Strangers.
Hopefully not, no. I mean, nobody's more disappointed than us, really. You know, I assure you that we're all really, you know, sort of devastated that we can't continue it at the moment. And yes, you know, here's hoping that we do somehow find a way to carry on and continue it. So thank you.
Well, and so as not to end on a down note, I did want to go back to something that I had mentioned at the top of the interview as we sort of close out, and that is that you were the first person that we interviewed for Secret Identity, the first creator that we interviewed, and that was, I want to say, geez, it was certainly in the spring of 2006, because I know you guys were building up to the launch of Wasteland.
Yeah, it would have been about 2 years ago. Yeah, wow.
And when Matt and I first got the email from you, that was huge for us because we, at the time, were still trying to figure out what Secret Identity was going to be about, what the format of the show was going to be, and the whole idea of interviewing creators really wasn't even something that had occurred to us yet. We were planning on sitting around, you know, talking to each other and recording that because we never, in our wildest dreams, thought that we could actually sit down and interview creators about the stuff that they're working on. And so the interview with you really set us on this path of, you know what, that went really well, even though we couldn't even record it properly the first time around. But just the concept of it was something that set us off on a course where that has become a staple of our show, you know, now to the point where you're featured as part of the creator spotlight on Secret Identity. That was something that you had a hand in shaping because you sort of gave us the confidence to go out and say, you know what, we should talk to more people and we should ask more people if they want to do an interview for the show. So I really have to give you a lot of credit for where we've gone with the show up to this point and just thank you for reaching out initially. And it's been a relationship that's been awesome and we want to support you in any way we can as well. So I really appreciate you taking the time again to talk to us and spend some time for our listeners' sake.
No, well, thank you. I mean, it's no problem. You know, more podcasts and videocasts and blogs and what have you should, you know. I mean, one of the things that's made interviews difficult, if you like, in the internet age is that, you know, well, is email, frankly, is that, you know, if you're doing a sort of a text interview, you put in an awful lot of work. You know, you're basically doing like 2 hours work or something to answer people's questions and what have you. Whereas, you know, if you're just sort of, as I am now, talking off the top of my head, you know, it's much easier. It's less, I don't want to, well, it is less effort, you know, and I don't mean that to sort of imply that we're lazy or what have you, but it doesn't, it's not as much of a drain on a creator's time. So I think more podcasts and video podcasts should approach creators, and I think you'd be surprised at how willing most creators are to, you know, to talk, because we don't get the opportunity to talk all that much. You know, we're freelancers. We sit at home all day with, you know, our wives, our children, and our dogs or cats or whatever, and we don't actually see an awful lot of the outside world. So, you know, most creators are quite happy to sit and chat for a while, I think. And I think, you know, from a sort of from my own background, actually working in publishing and in journalism, I think it's important to, you know, sort of personalize things in that way and to have creators be seen or heard and what have you, because I think it helps. I think it's more beneficial for the listener, certainly from a consumer's point of view. I am much more interested in interviews than I am in features, if you like. You know, as long as it's a good interview, I would always much rather watch or read or listen to an interview with, you know, a creator that I like or even somebody that I've never heard of than just read a sort of feature article about them, because I think you're getting, you know, a sort of a more honest and open dialogue, and it helps bring us into the public eye. And that's something that for comics creators, especially historically, has been very difficult. You know, I mean, we all know the historical horror stories of, you know, uncredited creators and what have you. So because we live in an age where doing stuff like this is now so easy, I mean, I'm literally sat at my desk in my study talking to my laptop, you know, and you're 5,000 miles away. How brilliant is that? I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm showing my age, I don't know, but to me, that's amazing. And it's, you know, so easy. So I think because it is so easy, it's important that we take advantage of that and, you know, help bring creators out into the open and, you know, remind people that there are real, remind readers that there are real people behind these comics, you know, and we are normal, everyday people just like yourselves. We just happen to work in our underwear.
Well, and that is the best part as I sit here recording this podcast in my pajamas. So that is great. And I think that's that is something that people really need to think about. I always find that hearing from the creators themselves, to me, is the best part of being a fan, whether it be movies or comic books or games or anything like that. And so we appreciate you indulging us once again. And obviously this is the first of hopefully many interviews we'll do in the future. And I just want to thank you again for taking time to talk to us. And good luck with all of the projects continued success with Wasteland and Dead Space, and we'll look forward to Wolverine and possibly Texas Strangers in the future.
Hopefully. Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
The necessities in life, like comic books, food, and gas, are not getting any cheaper. We can't do anything about the cover price, but you can shop around for a good discount to help you out. Or if you're one of the unfortunates who have lost their local comic book store, can Brian and I help you out? No, but Discount Comic Book Service can. At DCBS, it's so simple. You download your order form, you pick the shipping you want, whether it be weekly, bi-weekly, or monthly, pick your books, and just like that, comic books delivered right to your front door. Need bags and boards with your books? Bam! You got them. Now, each and every month, you choose from hundreds of titles at 40% off. But for deeper discounts, there's books for 50% off and, amazingly, 75% off the cover price as well. That brings many books to $1.25 a copy. And how long has it been since you paid a buck and a quarter for a new comic? And these are just a small sample of the discounts and incredible service offered at Discount Comic Book Service. So join many of the Secret Identity listeners that have experienced the ease and savings of DCBS. For more information, just go to www.dcbservice.com. And if trades are your game, www.instocktrades.com will blow you away with similar savings and a huge selection.